Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 185. Today's guest is a recently retired first baseman who had a great career, lots of wisdom to share, including experiences being a first rounder, being an early big leaguer at age 21, winning a World Series, going through free agency, playing in small markets and larger markets, and now kind of transitioning into the media aspect of baseball and retirement. So has a lot of wisdom to share across a lot of different disciplines, and I really enjoyed this interview. I actually picked up some good stuff that I think will help me, particularly with some of the younger players we work with and things that we communicate is important to them as they work through their careers. So I think we're in for a really good one. This episode is brought to you by AG1, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it can be difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can often wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where AG1 can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. That's why I use it daily, as do several of my family members, and we recommend it to a lot of our top athletes. One scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients that work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet to support energy, focus, digestion, and recovery. And this can all happen for less than $3 per day and without taking multiple products. While most nutritional supplements come to market and stay stagnant, AG1 continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing over 50 improvements in the last decade alone. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best-tasting nutrition habit on the planet. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it'll work for you, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. They put 75 ingredients through the rigorous NSF certification test to come up with a safe formula that's trusted by some of the world's top athletes, including many of our own at Cressy Sports Performance. Right now, AG1 is giving our listeners a special offer of 10 free travel packets with their first purchase. Just head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim this special offer. These travel packets are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health while you're traveling for games, training, or simply on the go. They can be great counterbalance to the less than ideal on the road food options that are out there for a lot of our traveling baseball players. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance of getting nutrient diversity, head to drinkag1.com/Cressy to get 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. You won't regret it. Today's guest is a first baseman who was raised in Florida. A two-time state player of the year, he committed to play at Arizona State, but opted to instead turn pro when he was selected third overall in the 2008 MLB draft by the Kansas City Royals. He was called to the big leagues by the Royals in 2011, a year in which he finished third in Rookie of the Year voting. Over a 13-year MLB career, he won a World Series, 4 Gold Gloves, and a Silver Slugger, and was both an All-Star Game MVP and World Baseball Classic champion. He retired after the 2023 season, ending a career that included time with the Royals, Padres, Red Sox, and Cubs. Over 1,689 regular season games, he hit .276 with a .335 on-base percentage, 198 homers, and 893 RBIs. Please welcome to the show, Eric Hosmer. Eric, welcome to the show. Really excited to chat with you.
Chris, appreciate it, man. How's everything going up there in Jupiter?
Everything is great, man. And I'm excited to talk about your new project, which we'll get to, because I know you've got some really cool things brewing since you joined the ranks of the retired. But maybe the best place to start is to backtrack to the high school years. I know you were super highly touted, you know, kind of high school prospect. Obviously, a lot of pressure that goes with going third overall and all that. But I read somewhere that you were a guy that went through like a big growth spurt in a short mm-hmm. amount of time in the high school years. Was there like this awkward, clumsy newborn giraffe stage, or how did that all play out?
There definitely was, man. It was so going from eighth grade to ninth grade, I grew like 2 inches. You know, I stretched out completely. I was always, you know, a bigger kid. I was, you know, average size. I was pretty thick. And then that freshman year, I shot up to about 6'1", 6'2", and like when I was running, I couldn't pick up my legs, man. Like I could not stride, pick up my legs. So there was definitely that awkward giraffe stage, like you're saying. Yeah. But it was weird, man, because like I just never had control of my body. When I got that big, it was like I still felt the strength. Yep. But to do anything, you know, mobility wise, flexibility wise, it's like I had no control of it. And then each year after, slowly kind of got some feel for the body.
It's interesting. We talked like Greg Rose, who's the Titleist Performance Institute, talks a lot about junior golfers. And like the best time ever to train power is when they go through growth spurts, because the bones stretch out, the muscles and tendons can't keep up. So you get really springy really fast. Maybe it doesn't work on the mobility side of things. But was that a transformative year in terms of just hitting the ball harder and moving quicker, even if it just didn't feel super coordinated?
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think that was something, you know, the strength always felt like it was there. And then it definitely opened my eyes as far as the mobility and all that type of stuff and the flexibility. That I really took a liking to that, because, you know, I'm watching guys run and like my leg is coming around, it literally won't leave the ground. It's just dragging that way. Mm-hmm. So there was a pitching coach on our high school team. His name's Scott Forsman, who I ended up working out with for, you know, pretty much my whole career. And he was always into weight training. He was always into lifting weights. So I'd always find myself talking to him. I'm like, man, how can I get a little more flexible? How can I work on this stuff? And that's really when, you know, I really bought in, because I started asking him questions. We started doing some stuff and I saw some early improvements.
I like that. You know, at like young ages, when you see like the, you know, quote unquote, big, strong kid, right? Mm-hmm. They always get thrown at first base, or maybe they come like pitcher only, stuff like that. Did you have to fight that? I mean, because you were, you know, fast forward, you were a guy that, I mean, I want to say you had some years where you stole close to 20 bags, you know, in the big leagues before it was the base stealing rules of today.
Right.
Like, you could run a little bit. Did you have to fight that slow, you know, methodical athlete type thing? Were you still in the outfield? Were you doing other things?
Yeah, so I did. I was first base, like you said, the whole time. My sophomore year and junior year, I played up on a couple summer league teams that were really good in the Florida area. So of course, I'm only going to play first. And then and that senior year, in between that time of getting drafted, and there was that August 15 deadline, I actually went out to Midland, which is Midland Redskins in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I spent the whole summer out there. And it was big for me because I got to do a lot of the, you know, mobility and strength work and all that type of thing. And, you know, I told the team as well that I wanted to kind of play some different areas, some different positions, you know, throw them in the outfield a couple games. That way, you know, if anything comes down the road, I've always had a good arm too. So anything comes down the road, you know, a team can put me out there and I feel comfortable. And it ended up happening my first couple of years in Kansas City, when interleague play was still a thing the DH wasn't involved. I went out to right field a couple games in Pittsburgh because we had Billy Butler, who was our full-time DH. So it really did pay off for me. But yeah, that the Midland team allowed me to go out and do some different things in the outfield was kind of like my different sport. You know what I mean? Guys learn a whole bunch of different movements by playing different sports. And for me, it was always just baseball. So that outfield experience really, really got it to where I saw the game in a different perspective and realized I needed to do certain things to my body to be able to withstand whatever the game throws at me.
I like that. And, you know, between that and actually getting going with like, you know, some organized strength conditioning at a younger age, I think it just kind of helps us to overcome a lot of the, hey, your base support's moving up away from your center of mass, your center of mass is moving to your base support, where you kind of go through that clumsy stage. Obviously, we're talking about what worked out for you, like what went well that made you a first rounder. I'm curious, when you look back on your high school years, were there also things that in hindsight didn't work, stuff that you tried that you thought would make you exponentially better that backfired one way or another?
Yeah, high school, I was just trying to get strong, man. You know what I mean? Like, you're trying to work out and build strength up any way you can. And I think that's something that, you know, we all would see the football guys working out in our weightlifting class in high school. And it's like, man, like, I want to put on some muscle. I want to be big and strong like these guys as well. And obviously, as you know, in baseball, it's a little different. You definitely have to build up the strength, but you got to be smart and tactical about how you build that strength up. Because if, you know, those muscles get too tight, you know, you can pop a groin or pull a hamstring and in no time. And you got to last that full 8 months, 162 games in that big league season. So, that was something that, you know, in high school, I really just, we would do our conditionings and we would do, the conditioning was more of like, just kind of a mental grind to really put you through something tough and hard and really get the guys in shape. So I just always, like I said, was talking to my coach Scott about it. And I'm like, man, how can we really like you know, specifically train to do this stuff and make it hard, but make sure I'm getting the full, you know, what I should be getting for baseball in baseball terms, so to speak. Like, I want to get strong, and at the same time, I want to lengthen the muscle so nothing tights up and I don't risk anything, you know, being pulled or any type of stuff like that. So I think that's really when the workouts started taking a whole new, it was a whole new vision of the workouts, where it was still strength and conditioning, or it was still strength. And at the same time, we're doing some different movements that we were doing, swinging a bat, trying to get a little more flexible at the same time as well.
I love that. And you obviously prepared you, like, you're, I think this is actually a really cool time to ask this question, just because I just saw the other day, like, position player debuts in the big leagues are just getting younger and younger every year. We're seeing so many guys who, you know, Juan Soto is obviously that guy who went up, I think, at 19, like, that's an exceptional rule, but you were up at 21, and we're seeing way more guys at 21, 22, 23 going up. So you went fast, and there was some talk publicly about whether, you know, the Royals should or shouldn't rush you to the big leagues. You obviously were ready for it. You finished top three in rookie of the year voting. But I'm curious, when you look back in hindsight, were there certain things about your preparation, your demeanor, any of that stuff that made you a good candidate to be a guy who tolerated and thrived in the big leagues at such a young age?
Yeah. I mean, so the cool thing about baseball is, like, after every season, you kind of look back on your season before, you evaluate certain things. And I've always had, you know, some great mentors in each of those, you know, areas in the game, whether it's hitting, whether it was how my body felt, you know, all that type of stuff. So after my rookie year playing that, you know, full 160 game slate, 162 games, whatever it was, I kind of sat back, and the first couple of days, Scott and I were in the gym, and we're just kind of talking about how the season went. What did I feel throughout the season? And, you know, there was a point in time where, especially in Kansas City, it gets hot and humid to where, like, towards the end, I felt like I was kind of running out of energy a little bit, you know, like, it was, luckily, when you walk out into that stadium and there's a bunch of people in the stands, you get that adrenaline rush, and that kind of carries you on through. But I felt like I didn't want that rush to get me going. I wanted to get going before that. So we were trying to find ways to tweak workouts during the season, because up until that point, it was basically workout in the off season to get strong, and we're going to do a little bit during season to maintain. But then after that year, I realized I needed to do a little more to maintain that. And that's really where, you know, the scheduling of the in-season lifts tried to come, or started to come. And it was like, all right, you know, how do we go about doing this? And each year after that, next 2-3 years, it was kind of like a trial and error type thing that we were just keeping constant dialogue.
And that's a process that evolves, you know, playing into your early 30s, like, you probably do a little bit less because the foundation is a little bit better. And I think people forget that, like, the process doesn't have to be the same process forever. It's got to be a little bit of a moving target. But talk about when you got to the big leagues, right? Because, you know, you see all these guys that come up, they thrive for 20 games, and then the league corrects to them, and they have to learn, you know, how to adjust to the adjustments. Like, was that a big thing for you when you went up? Were there quick adjustments on the fly that needed to happen to be successful?
Yeah, just because you realize, like you said, the teams are adjusting to you so fast. It was like the minor leagues, you know, whatever league you were in, say there's 6 or 7 teams there. You go to one team for 3-4 games, you play that series, and they have their kind of scouting report on you and what they think works against you. Then you go to the next team, and they have a different scouting report on you of what they think's from times where we've played them and all that type of thing, or whatever their scouts are telling them. And then when you get to the big leagues, you realize everybody is watching every single game. So whatever your flaws are, teams are going to see that right away. Whether it's back in the day, the scouts would see every game, but now there's a lot of information out there that just prints out whatever your flaws are and tells them. So yeah, you definitely realize that it's adjustment after adjustment. And I remember Tommy Pham, one of my teammates, would tell me that to have a good year throughout the season, it's basically 4 adjustment periods you got to go through. You know, you start out hot, the league makes their adjustment, you kind of adjust back. And when you're done at this, when you're done after that 162, it's kind of like, this happened about 3-4 times. And that's how you know you had a good year, when you're kind of making the adjustment and they're trying to counter.
Yeah. I'm curious, how would you you translate that to a, all right, so Zach Geloff, right, was a guest on this podcast a couple weeks ago. I've known Zach since he was 15. 14 homers, 14 stolen bases, American League, a rookie of the month in August last year, and he's off to a good start in spring. Like, you sit down, you have lunch with Zach, what's the feedback that you're going to give to him that basically is something that's going to help him in his sophomore season?
Yeah, to evaluate that type of a season, evaluate what went good, what you think went wrong. And then at the end of the day, whatever you think went wrong, it's like, how are we going to approach that? How are we going to handle that? And, you know, it's tough because at the same time, you want to be a complete player and you don't want to have holes and you want to work on, you know, making whatever those holes are better for you in some aspect. But if your holes are, you know, you swung at a back foot slider too much and you were chasing, you're not going to go in the offseason trying to figure out how to hit a back foot slider. You're going to figure out, all right, maybe that's a pitch I need to lay off. Yeah. Maybe I look a little higher. If I understand that's what a pitcher likes to go to, I'm going to tunnel it differently, or my approach is going to be something different to get me looking in a different spot. So I think that's something that young players really, you know, need to kind of understand and then find that balance of, like we talked about, I'm not going to go try and hit back foot sliders. If it's a well-executed pitch, there's nothing I can do about it. How do I figure out a way to maybe just minimize me chasing at that pitch and go about it, you know, in a different way?
I love that. Will Middlebrooks was a guest a while back, and I remember him distinctly saying a good approach will solve a lot of mechanical issues. Would you agree with the same thing?
Yeah, no doubt. And I'm a victim of it. I think guys nowadays, you get so overcomplicated in mechanics and want to do this and want to feel this in the plate that you kind of lose your approach. And, you know, that first pitch heater goes by, or there's a pitch that, you know, the pitcher maybe hung a curveball and you're so worried about your mechanics and what you're doing that, you know, you forget about the timing, you forget about what your approach is, and you let that pitch go by. So I 100% agree with that. And it got to a point where if I felt a little too mechanical and I was worrying about certain things, I would kind of just try and erase the thoughts, and ground one or ground zero, really level one, was just worry about the approach and worry about the timing and trust the rest will come.
I love that. And you know, I was a fair weather Royals fan, you could say, back in the day, right? So we had mutual friend, Tim Collins. Tim was one of our, you know, kind of like our first, you know, guys who was with us all the way through the minor leagues, got to the big leagues. So I was at opening day, I think it was March 31st, 2011. That was a young team, right? That was Timmy and Adcock and Crow and you and Moustakas. There were a lot of guys that debuted that year. So, you know, it was a team that went through growing pains, but what was really cool, I mean, that team was in the World Series in 14, and then it was World Series champion in 15. And that coincided with your first, you know, 3 to 4 years in the big leagues. I'm curious, you know, we've talked about Eric Hosmer developmentally as a player. Like, what made that team a world championship team in a matter of, you know, 3.5 years, really, from when you first went to the big leagues?
Yeah, we had a unique situation because a lot of us came up together in the minor leagues. So a lot of us were, you know, getting promoted together. We definitely wanted to win. You know what I mean? I think it's a day and age. And I mean, even back then, you can't blame somebody if your team's having a great year and you're winning championships in the minor leagues, but you're not getting promoted. You know, that's kind of, you know, that's you're going to be happy you won, but you want to be promoted at the end of the day. So we had a unique ability of really just taking on that battle of a full season together. And it felt like we were on a baseball, like a summer team, you know what I mean? So the individual battle was definitely hard. It was a grind, but we were taking that all on together. And when we all got to the big leagues, I mean, it wasn't instant success for all of us, you know? And I think all of us were really trying to sit around each night and kind of talk about what we think we've discovered and figured out, and vice versa. So we were just all so open. I think we all were kind of learning together that once we felt we had a little bit of success and individually felt like we belonged there, then, you know, the team stuff from that point on really took off. And I think that's where, you know, we really started getting competitive. That second half in 13, I'll never forget, we opened up the All-Star break and won like 8 out of 9 games. And it was the first nine day road trip coming out of the break, and finished the second half with the best record in the second half. And we all kind of went home like, damn, we can do this for another half of baseball. And then that next year was 14 when we went to the World Series, like you're saying.
Did you guys, I know one of the debated points in baseball, it's kind of like everyone's speculating, like how do you improve the minor leagues? Like, not enough, you know, players are focused on winning. Like, I know a lot of guys have joked about the Cardinal way in the past, when Lance Lynn telling me like he always felt the Cardinal way was that they really emphasize winning in the minor leagues. Did you guys have that dynamic where, hey, this isn't just a double A game, like we're trying to win every game, or did it still have a little bit more of a developmental feel where the losses happened?
It was both, but part of that developmental ladder, if you want to call it, like the Royals, they would not call you up until they felt that you were ready to play in a big league game. And what does that mean? And that's like, you know, you need to be in the right spots. You need to know when to be the cutoff man or when to cover a certain base. And there was kind of a little checklist that you really had to do. And in the minor leagues back then too, they would always tell guys like, yeah, you're hitting 3-4 hole for us in the minor leagues. But if you go to the big leagues, you're going to be hitting 6th or 7th because they got superstars up there right now. So, you know, in a day and age where the bunting was something, you had to know how to sacrifice a guy over there. Yeah. You had to show the ability to get a guy over if it's late in the game and it's a close game and we need that run to win or whatnot. So there was definitely aspects of the game that they would not call you up until they felt that you were comfortable enough to understand all that. So I think that's really for the developmental side for the Royals. I think that was something that kind of made us play that team game, was knowing they're not going to call us up unless we show that we know what this consists of and we're willing to do that.
I love that. Switching gears. I joke often. I had this conversation with Tom Kohler. I'm like, retired guys are the most honest guests. Like, when we talk to active players, nobody wants to give away their secrets. They don't want to say what pitches they can't hit or what pitches they can't execute. You're retired and you can spill the beans. So, like, what was it, a pitch that was impossible for you to hit? And, like, who was it that absolutely owned you? And then we'll do the vice versa afterwards.
There's a few guys I feel like that owned me out there, especially some of those lefty relievers. But for me, it was anything coming into me. If it was a lefty that had a two-seamer, a sinker, it was real hard for me to really stay inside that pitch and get the barrel out. And a righty, all these righties nowadays have cutters. And that's like my nightmare for a righty, is something coming into me. You know, I was the guy that had a lot of barrel lag, and I would go the opposite way, especially early in my career, real well, because I would see it a little deeper. My barrel would kind of lag, and I would just shoot stuff the other way. So that got really hard when guys were going east to west and a righty had that cutter and a changeup at the same time, because if I knew he was coming inside, I really wanted to try and get the barrel out there and pull something and drive something to the pull side. But that didn't allow me to see the ball as long, you know, and have that ability to shoot at oppo. So the cutter from a right-hander and the two-seamer from a lefty, anything kind of going into me, that was something that gave me fits. And there are some lefties out there in the bullpen that would – I felt like some teams were trading them just for me and just for have that 7th or 8th inning type thing. And Andrew Miller, when he got to Cleveland, he was a guy that, you know, he would always find my spot in the lineup. It was like me and then Moose, or Moose and then me. So he would come in through that. So he's a guy that definitely rings, that rings my bell as far as, man, I don't think I did too well off this guy, because I know it wasn't a comfortable at bat.
Well, and then he had that wipeout slider after he came in on you. Oof, so there was this. What about guys that you love to face? I mean, it was the exact opposite, guys where you get your arms extended, stuff like that.
There were some guys I had good numbers off of, and I just saw the ball well. I don't know why. Like Salazar in Cleveland, for some reason, I saw the ball well off him, and he's like 97 to 99, but he's a strike thrower. The guys that weren't, you know, effectively wild, and I didn't think my life was in danger, I would dig in a little more against them, and I thought it was good. And a weird one for me was, I actually have good numbers off Chris Sale, and man, like, I did not like facing Chris Sale at all. I mean, it's angle, it's extension, it seems like the ball's coming from first, but somehow I had some good numbers off him and had some success. But that was not a guy that, if I was facing him tomorrow, I was really looking forward to coming to the field on.
Yeah, I'm going to jump around because I'm actually really fascinated. I had this question a couple down, but so your career spanned a big range of competition. Average basketball velocity probably dropped 3 ticks over the course of your playing career. Pitch design became a thing, which really wasn't around before. You know, we started seeing more usage of adrenotronic cameras probably around 2016, 2017. So hitting got a lot harder in between 2011, 2023.
Oh, yeah.
What did you have to do to evolve? Because, you know, we talked to guys like, oh, I faced Randy Johnson. I'm like, there are some guys that are pretty darn close to Randy Johnson coming out every night at guys throwing 100. We faced a guy last year who was like the last guy in a bullpen who came out when a pitcher got injured, and he rolls out a first pitch is 97 as the last guy in a bullpen. It's so different. So there were things that you did differently over the course of time. And then also, how would you have evolved maybe earlier if you saw this coming?
Yeah. So now the way a lot of hitting coaches explain it, and I love how they talk about the hitting, is you need multiple clubs. You know what I mean? It's like kind of like golf. You need multiple clubs to go up there. It's not, you know, you go up there and it's one approach, one swing for a guy, and that's not going to work with, you know, the arsenal you're seeing from the big league level. It's it's more of a, all right, today is a East and West guy. You know what I mean? How do we figure that out? Or today's a guy with some VAA. He's going to be at the top of the zone. So how are we going to work on being on top of this pitch and not missing under it? So each day is a different approach and a different kind of mission that you got to go up there and know who you're identifying, what type of pitcher you're facing, and then how do you go about doing that? And, you know, that was one thing too, that was also a big change, was we talked about these teams knowing your holes and knowing what you really couldn't do. And every pitcher wants to have, you know, what do we call it? Like a two seam and then a cutter. It's basically, it's a simple word I'm missing.
Tunnels.
Right? Yeah. The tunnels right. And they work with the catchers on, you know, how they want to work you. Let's go two seam in and they'll set up that. And, you know, that's kind of what they're doing. But now these pitchers will just constantly pound that one pitch you can't hit. Yeah. So instead of, you know, really trying to mix up fastball, curveball to you, it's like, we'll just throw him six cutters on the inner half because we know that is something he struggles with. And until he proves that he can hit that, we're not going to do anything but pound that cutter in on his hands. So as a hitter, you can't really tell yourself, I'm going to lay off this pitch when they're throwing it seven times in a row and, you know, they're throwing it for strikes. So you really have to have that different club and know what you're going to do and how to use that.
That's interesting.
That's the word I was looking for.
Sorry, sequencing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
As you kind of progress, like obviously, I think we talked a little bit at one point about, you know, using Traject and some of like the random practice initiatives. Did you start taking more of that on? Because I mean, as a veteran guy, like you, nobody wants to fail at 5 o'clock, right? When they could be out there like peppering the stands and BP and stuff. But some guys have seen great results with, you know, some of that or eye pitch or even just, you know, having somebody fooling you in the cage. Were you a guy that took on some of those things in your later years?
Yeah, definitely. That was because, like you said, the velocity is so high now and they're coming from pitch one. So it's one of those things where it's like, I want to be ready for pitch one. I don't want it to be 2-3 pitches into the at bat. And I feel like now, you know, my eyes are catching up to the velocity and seeing that. So a lot of these guys now, I think, like you said, the Traject is something that's great. You can kind of get your timing down because you can see the pitcher's motion. You can see his wind up and know, all right, this is my cue to go, or this is when I'm going to start everything up. And, you know, they have those new foam balls now that you can go in the machine and you can dial the machine up to about 110, 115, and you can take some swings out there. You don't got to worry about your hand blowing up or anything like that. Because one of the hardest things as a hitter is you want to make adjustments and you want to feel good about the adjustments. But if I go into a batting cage and you're flipping to me from 5 feet or 10 feet away or throwing BP, I'm going to smash every pitch. You know what I mean? If I'm an elite hitter. So it's one of those things where a machine or a Traject, something like that, is really how the closest way to simulate in that bat. So I think that's the big way you can make an adjustment because it feels like it's a live at bat.
Yeah, I think people forget just how long the season is and just, you know, you got to use your bullets carefully, particularly as you age. You know, it's not an option to just go in there and hack for an hour and a half. And I'm sure you've seen a ton of guys who have career years just because they stop hitting BP on the field and they get in some really high quality 15 or 20 swings in the cages and that's it. It's amazing.
No question. BP on the field is becoming one of the most like biggest question marks, in my opinion, on the game, because there's so many guys that are, you know, these are top level players that are like, listen, I don't need to do that. I can do my work in the cage. And I feel like that's what it is, but you hit it on the head. As you get older, as an older player, you know, you can't just go in there and take 100, 200 swings and try and figure stuff out that way. It's like, man, I only have a certain amount of bullets. So each swing is that much more important. And I really need to value each swing I'm taking because I don't have 100 or 200 bullets in the tank.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard more guys being like, you know, I'll hit on field on the first day of a series, get used to the stadium, the surroundings, and then pull back thereafter.
We interrupt this podcast with a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by AG1. It's an NSF certified all-in-one superfood supplement that features 75 whole food sourced ingredients designed to support your body's nutritional needs. I use this product daily myself, and a ton of our athletes do as well. Head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim my special offer of 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. AG1 gives you peace of mind that you're covering all your nutritional bases. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, and you'll get that special offer.
Maybe piggyback on that. You were insanely durable over the course of your career. You played over 150 games 8 times. In an era where injuries were going up exponentially. And I think it would have been 9. I think you got hit on the hand by a pitch. So it wasn't anything that was like super preventable. looking back, I mean, I know we talked a little about kind of your developmental approach to strength conditioning and taking care of your body. Were there key things that kept you, you know, out there consistently and off the IL over the course of a season when you talk about the actual in-season approach?
Yeah, just staying consistent to the program, staying consistent to the routine. I think kind of like we talked about those first couple of years when you reflect on the season and what could we have done better, especially from a body standpoint, it's like, man, like I don't want to hit that wall in September or August. You know what I mean? When, you know, August rolls around, it's always a tough time of year. It's kind of a dead month. And, you know, you're close to September and that September push is going to kind of, you know, get you to the finish line and hopefully you're in a pennant race and all that stuff take care of itself. But once I started really trying to critique the in-season lifts and tweak, you know, what I liked and what I didn't like, that was something that really helped a lot. And, you know, the beginning of my career, I would try and get kind of one upper, one lower in each series, especially if it was a 4-game series. And then towards the end, I felt like, you know, I was kind of just more PT work on those night games and getting ready for the games. And then on day games, I would like to lift because it kind of woke me up a little bit. It woke me up and got me going. And, you know, the older I got, I, you know, had a little boy, so I was getting up early already. So I felt like I wanted to kind of turn the engine on a little more for that day game. And that's kind of something I switched to towards the end of my career. But like you said, it was just tweaking constantly on the go. But early on, I think those years, I think the in-season lifting really, really helped me out and it kept me feeling strong. And I think that's what kept me durable throughout the year.
Were you a guy that like scrutinized your body weight a lot? I mean, I know historically, like a lot of players had a hard time keeping weight on in Kansas City. It gets hot out there, especially in the olden days before they got the new stadium and it was, you know, 120 degrees out there. Was that something that you paid close attention to? Did you kind of play a similar weight your whole career or did it adjust over the years?
That was more of a feel thing for me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I really wouldn't pay too much attention to it just because, like you said, it was Kansas City. It was so hot. We were dropping weight a bunch and all that type of thing. But even like those later years in Kansas City towards the end, you know, if I went back one night and, you know, crushed some pasta and pizza and all that type of stuff, I would definitely start feeling it the next day. So I think that having those like sluggish feels and, you know, really like trying to find ways to get going after nights like that, I think that's kind of something that, you know, started bringing the nutrition thoughts into my mind. And, you know, that was something that, you know, I tried to stay away from having that feeling as much as possible. So I feel like that kind of took care of that weight, those weigh-ins for me throughout the year.
I've run an impromptu or a very informal study of pro guys in the off season. You can tell a lot about how someone responds to nutrition by how they feel on Friday, Black Friday, right after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You see guys at like 29:30, everybody comes in, they're complaining about how lethargic they are and how much their joint hurts. And then all the 23-year-olds walk in feeling like strong as an ox, all carved up to get after it.
Yep.
But speaking of changes, baseball is very different now, right? There's, you know, we got a pitch clock. We got, no, banning the shift. I'm curious, like I know like you wouldn't be getting more involved now in baseball in the media, you know, zone, which we'll talk about it, if you didn't love the game and you didn't follow the game and you didn't appreciate kind of the beauty of it and how it's evolved. I'm curious, what do you see baseball moving towards in the years ahead? You know, is there a new market inefficiency that you think teams are going to exploit? Like where's your head at on where baseball's headed?
I'm always gonna, you know, watch baseball. I love baseball and I feel like I speak baseball. So it's always fun to watch games, catch up with friends and talk about what you think's going on or even, you know, keep in touch with some of the players that are going on now and understanding what's happening now in the game and the changes and all that type of stuff. So I love the new rules. I love everything about trying to make the game more entertaining. And I came up when, you know, it was still kind of a old school type thing where you didn't really show much emotion and you didn't really, you know, celebrate on the field or do any of that stuff. And then, you know, I think now it's cool. Like if you're not showing up the other team and you're not disrespecting anybody on the other team, then yeah, celebrate with your guys. I think the youth, the younger kids love seeing it and, you know, they bring it to their games and it energizes the sport a little bit. So I love that. Where baseball is at right now, Major League Baseball to me is, you know, it's a cool spot. It's a tough spot because you see a lot of guys now that are in these small market organizations and they're getting these crazy deals at like $200-300 million or the kid in Milwaukee that just got 90 or whatever that was. So I think these small market teams are really trying to identify who that superstar player is And if this is a player that they felt like when he gets to about year two or three of arbitration, we can't keep him and hold on to him. He's going to get too expensive. They're kind of going on a limb now and predicting that, hey, this is a guy that's going to be like that. Let's give him that 10-year, 11-year deal. So it's going to be great if it works out and these teams and these players can stay together and they can build a foundation off them. But it can certainly get risky, you know, if some of these guys don't pan out and the team's $200 or $200 million down and it's a small market team and they can't really respond otherwise.
That's fascinating. Shifting gears a little bit, you know, 15 plus years in professional baseball. And to give you context, a lot of people listening to this podcast are coaches. They're, you know, players and parents riding to games together. They're minor league players, they're big leaguers, you name it. Everyone interacts with a wide variety of coaches, whether they're as peers or actual, you know, the ones getting coaches. When you look back at the people who helped you the most to have, you know, a long, successful career, what are some of the qualities of those coaches, whether it was high school, you know, minor leagues, major leagues, that you feel like helped you the most along your path?
Yeah, just being able to have a dialogue with them and, you know, understand that, you know, this person wants the best for me and is trying to maximize everything for me in my career. And, you know, understanding that it's not going to be everything you want to hear at times. And I think that's a big hump to get over, creating that dialogue and creating that relationship with somebody. And, you know, that's something that Scott and I, my trainer, have really have grown. And I think that's why we've grown so close together to the point where, you know, he's one of my best friends now, because we have that dialogue. We have that constant conversation where it's back and forth. And, you know, there were some times where he would, you know, tell me the truth and it wasn't what I wanted to hear, but at the end of the day, he knew it was best for me. And I think that's what really got our relationship, you know, taken off. And to me, the coach to player, the trainer to player relationship is just, you got to know how hard the game is. Number one, you know, you got to understand these guys are going out trying to do the hardest thing it is to do in all professional sports, whether it's hit a baseball or even on the pitching side, it's hard as well. So you got to understand that. And two, I think you got to just be real with the person. You know, I think players, especially older players, want truth and they want to know, this guy's not just telling me this just to, you know, for me to keep him in my corner or me to keep him on my side or whatever it is. So to be able to have that kind of trust that, you know, this person wants the best thing for me, this guy wants to, you know, maximize my career, so that's why he's telling me this, is something that I think is big for the player.
I love that. Towards the end of your career, you switched, right? You had been, you know, kind of a smaller market in Kansas City, and then you went to a, you know, larger market in San Diego. And then you went to two really big markets in Boston and Chicago at the end. And certainly those are very different media environments. You know, I'm curious, you know, having gone through that, obviously, you know, being a guy who's had a presence on social media, are there big rock lessons that you think young players, you know, whether it's high school, college, pro guys, really need to appreciate about how they interact with the media, how they use, you know, social media for better or for worse?
Yeah, definitely. I saw the transition firsthand when I was in San Diego, because, you know, it was always like, man, the West Coast players, guys can't stay up to watch them and you don't really hear about these guys and know about them. Then I got home that first year when Tatis he debuted for San Diego, and every single kid that I ran into down here was asking me how he's like, what's he like, all that type of thing. Because they can go on social media and they can see his highlights, they can follow him, and they get to see all those late night highlights that they didn't see the night before. Yeah. So that's really when I saw the transition. And it's crazy, man. It really is, because not only, you know, these guys that are in those big time markets like Boston and Chicago, you know, they have the media that's following them, huge fan bases that are following them. But then, you know, all that stuff's kind of at the field. And before, it was like, you get away from the field, you can get home and try and, you know, be away from all that stuff. But nowadays you pick up your phone and it's on Twitter, it's on Instagram. Even if you're logging on there to try and just see what your friends are doing, the algorithm's going to find a way to show you all these different type of articles and what's going on. So that was something that I really noticed too, towards the end of my career, where a lot of guys, like in the beginning of my career, were hiring strength coaches and going home in the off season, finding that personal guy, to now a lot of guys are really trying to find that mental skills coach or a process and development coach, because it's hard to block all that noise. And especially as a young player now that's going through it in high school and you're seeing friends commit to colleges and all that, I couldn't imagine how hard it is for those type of guys.
That's huge. And you know what I always tell guys is, like, there's no like gray area. Either are or aren't mature enough to handle it. Like, sometimes it's just get it out of your life, and you know, it's one less distraction. And some people handle it perfectly fine. So,
yeah.
All right, man. We always end with a lightning round. Which hitters do you like to watch in today's game, and why?
So today's game, from the right side, let's go with Goldschmidt. I mean, just so simple, repeatable. Yeah. The approach, the mechanics, and the consistency that he's been able to have has been unbelievable. You know, the year he won the MVP, I remember the year before, and man, I just remember watching his at bats all the time, and he was lining out left and right, and he was barreling balls to the track. So it was almost like you saw that coming, because if those balls fell, then you knew he was going to do something. But yeah, he excites me, man. I know that wasn't really a lightning round answer, but I had to go in a little further.
I think that's a great one, man. And I've gotten to know Paul real well over the last couple of years when he's been training down here, and just sneaky, impressive numbers over the years. People didn't really hear about him in Arizona, but he's a perennial, you know, top five player in baseball every single
year.
Stealing bases, playing good defense, all of it.
Doing it all. And St. Louis isn't a hitter's park, hitter's friendly park by any means. So to me, that makes those numbers that much more impressive.
Also a guy who's crazy efficient in his cage work. You know, we talked earlier about not wasting reps in the wrong places. Like he gets his body right, and it's, you know, 15 swings and in a good place.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's talk teenage Eric Hosmer. You can go back in time and give him some advice. What's your number one thing you're telling him?
Just to understand all the stuff we're talking about, the nutrition, the work, and all that type of stuff, that if you can get going on that at an early age, that's going to help you even more on the back end. So that's something that I wish I could have really, really took to heart and believed all the people that were telling me that, because, you know, towards those last couple of years, you definitely felt a lot of that stuff a lot more than you did the early years.
We said there's a lot of parents and kids in cars listening to this. Mom just pulled over to the side of the road and applauded because you just delivered the message that she's been trying to deliver.
Eat your veggies, kids. Yeah.
I love it. All right. Last but not least, you guys, along with another long-term friend of mine, Anthony Saratelli, you guys got some really cool stuff in the works with Moonball Media. I know a lot of guys retire and they ride off into the sunset for a few years. You're right back in the fray of baseball. Talk to me about, you know, what led you to jump back in on this, where it came from, and then obviously most importantly, like how people can check it out.
Yeah. So just, you know, in a day and age now, like we talked about, where the game is getting harder and harder and, you know, the stuff off the field is getting harder and harder. I just want to help guys out and, you know, I want to take that a step further than the guys that I have, you know, relationships with already, whether it's through text message or talking to them on the phone and all that type of stuff. And I want to help that kid that's with his mom in the car right now and has the ability to listen to us. And for me, this is what that's going to be. This is an outlet for that. It's going to be able to, you know, we're going to be able to dive into some cool stories with some guys. We're going to hear about guys having failure in their life and how they responded to that and kind of what little things help them with that on a mental side. And then on a physical side, what's some stuff they do to help out. So, you know, kind of like you with everything that you've done at Cressy, and you have your network of guys that are with you every day and you get to work with, you get to expand that now and doing something like this to where someone that, you know, isn't in Jupiter, Florida, that can't work with you, they can listen to something and try and pick up something in their game. So just trying to expand, give back to the game that we all love. And, you know, this is going to be cool for me because, you know, I'm going to be able to share a lot of different stories, spend a lot of time with my family. So it's going to be something different and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, already a few episodes out. It's really good stuff. Great production value, all that stuff too. So folks can find it. Probably Instagram is a good place to look. It's Moonball_media. And then it's just moonballmedia.com, I assume, right?
That's right.
Nice. Really good stuff. Encourage everybody to check it out. They've had some awesome guests already. So I'm a devout follower already.
I appreciate
Hey, man,
that.
This was awesome. Really, really cool to get to know you a little bit more and dig deep on some questions with a guy who's had a lot of success across a lot of levels, both individually and as a team. So appreciate you sharing the time.
Absolutely. A lot of fun, man. I know we'll see each other in the future at some point. So I look forward to it.
Absolutely. Thanks, bud.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.